This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
What's up, preacher man?
The United States launches a military strike with the largest non-nuclear bomb in our arsenal. What's the fallout? Find out now on The Patriot Preacher. Good morning, everyone. Happy Friday. Welcome to The Patriot Preacher. I am Caleb Colquitt. You all know my producer, Joe Marcus. Lots to cover today. Now, it seems like these stories are just coming right next to each other, which I think only escalates the sense of urgency that they come with. The Moab bomb was dropped yesterday in Afghanistan on ISIS forces. It's called the Moab, the massive ordnance air blast bomb. It's the biggest non-nuclear bomb in our arsenal. It weighs 22,000 pounds. In fact, this thing is so massive that we can't drop it with a bomber. We have to have an actual cargo plane with the bomb in the back, open up the hatch, and just push it out the door. That's the only way we can deliver this bomb. We don't have a plane big enough to actually deliver the bomb in the more traditional sense. So we have to drop it out of a cargo plane just to deliver this particular warhead. And it caused a very big boom. That's the most polite way to put it. But what all happened with this? I actually really like the nickname for it, because the actual acronym MOAB stands for Massive Ordnance Air Blast. But the nickname is Mother of All Bombs, which also fits with the MOAB acronym there. I really thought that was quite amusing. And what this bomb specifically was designed to do, I don't know if it was designed to do this. I mean, it's just designed to make a very big boom. But the reason that this was orchestrated and dropped in this particular location is because they needed a blast big enough to take out the tunnel networks that ISIS has been using for a while. And when I'm talking about tunnel networks, you know, we might be thinking about what we see sometimes at the border or in prison movies, where it's a tunnel that's maybe large enough to fit a person or a person in like a little bitty cart or something like that. That's not what's going on here. That's not the kind of tunnels that they were targeting. ISIS has tunnel networks underneath Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, lots of places in the Middle East that are so large. They're big enough to fit a two-lane road. Some of them are even high enough to fit an entire transfer truck across this road. I mean, these things are massive. And they have infrastructure down there. They're very stable. And because of that, it's very hard to take out their lines of supply. And that's become a real issue for us. So what this bomb did, and the reason that they used it, is because they needed a blast big enough to take down one of these tunnels and interrupt their supply chain. So that was the reasoning behind it. Now, could we have done essentially the same thing with smaller warheads? Probably, but if you've got it, why not use it? I don't have a problem with that personally. If we just needed a little bit of overkill to get the job done, that seems to be what they were doing here, is making sure that they got everything taken care of, made sure that they weren't going to have to use a secondary strike. And it all did it all at one time. And, you know, so far as that goes, it seems like this was a very effective. I hope that it was a successful mission, that we did get rid of those tunnels, and that hopefully will interrupt ISIS's supply chain for at least some time. It had enough of a blast area. So I don't think, so far from all the headlines that I've read, there's not even a massive death toll or anything. There's not even, I mean, probably some people did die because it was their supply chain. There were probably people down there in the tunnels. But this was not a bomb that was targeted at people per se. It was more targeted at infrastructure. Because if there were some people that died, it was probably because they were going along those supply chains. And so this wasn't targeting like an ISIS base or an ISIS training camp or ISIS troops. It was targeting specifically those tunnel networks. So the casualties that happened probably were not what you would expect from a warhead this big, but it was just that wasn't really its purpose. Its purpose was to knock out these supply chains. So hopefully that helps. Hopefully that keeps the forces at bay. Apparently this all had to do with a Green Beret that got killed, and apparently they connected it to this, and that was part of the spark that fueled this. A lot of people, though, right now are making this about Trump. And it's understandable that you could kind of just see the headline, not read any further, and jump to this conclusion, because what just happened a few days ago? I mean, a week ago, we were launching Tomahawk missiles at Syria, and that was totally Trump's call. This is a little different. Now, Trump is the commander-in-chief, and he came out saying that he authorized the use of the MOAB. So that is absolutely accurate. It's fine to say that or to talk about that. But here's the thing. If you know a little bit of the history of this particular warhead, it was designed and was going to be put into use under President Obama. Now, Obama never authorized it, possibly because he didn't want to use it, but it's also highly possible that they didn't have a mission where they thought they would need it. And so the idea that this is only a Trump thing, that this would only happen, we were at war with ISIS in Afghanistan and had airstrikes and things of that nature during Obama's time. There was not one with a warhead this big, but that was because we didn't have it the entire time. And when we did have it, there probably wasn't a mission that called for it. So we can make this about Donald Trump if you want to, and I realize that part of the reason is the closeness and proximity to the strike in Syria, which was 100% on Obama. It was his idea. He's the one that went forward with it. This one, he authorized it. But the idea that he's just going around fighting everybody and this is proof of that, that's not really a fair claim to make. Now, it may prove one day that that is what he's doing, but this incident does not lead us to that conclusion. So it's important to understand that. By the way, just kind of on a side note, because I thought this would be fun to bring up. My fellow Bible scholars out there, I wonder if anyone else found it funny that we're dropping a bomb called the Moab in the Middle East. Because for those of you who know your Old Testament history, Moab was the country directly to the east of Jerusalem. And so we have in the Middle East a country called Moab. Now, they don't exist anymore. Now that's where Jordan is. But so it's not even in Afghanistan, but just not real far from where Moab used to be. We dropped a Moab bomb on ISIS in Afghanistan. I just thought that was funny. Made me chuckle.
Me too. And also, I have to admit, I'd heard the name, but I could not quite put it, kind of relate it to that part of the world. It was something I knew, and I knew there was something. Now you have educated me.
Yeah, a lot of people will recognize it, A, from some of the books of prophecy where the prophets would talk about Moab because, of course, they were in close proximity to Israel, and also the Moabitess Ruth. So a whole book of the Bible is written about a Moabite. And so there you go. So Moab did play an important part in Old Testament history, but kind of getting off subject there, but still, I thought it was fun. Now, you might be asking why today I seem to not really have a problem with this strike when, you remember, a week ago I was pretty critical of the Trump administration for the strike on Syria. Well, I think it's a good time to explain myself. Here's why. This is a completely different set of circumstances. First of all, we're already at war with Afghanistan. Whether you agree with that or not, whether you like the war in Afghanistan or not, that is a fact. We are already at war in Afghanistan. This is not starting a new conflict. It's something that's been going on for a while. So the consequences are not nearly the same. Also, ISIS has no formal government or military. Attacking ISIS, because ISIS is pretty much reviled by the rest of the world, there's really not any consequences to us on the world stage for attacking ISIS. We've been at war with ISIS for some time. Not a formal war, but, you know, the war on terror in general includes ISIS. And that's something that the UN has been targeting. Heck, even the Afghan government is fighting them. So when it comes to this, we're not fighting a actual country. And with the most important thing to me is that Russia isn't in Afghanistan. If Russia had no connection to Syria, I probably wouldn't have had much of an issue
with the Tomahawk missiles. I was worried about what happens between us and Russia. And we've seen in the coming weeks that there was some legitimacy to worry about that. Now, we don't know what the results are. We're going to have to wait and see exactly what Russia does. But as far as the airstrike in Syria, that was an incredibly risky call. And we're still not sure exactly what all the repercussions are going to be from it. Nobody's going to come after us because of this Afghanistan thing. So with me, see, that's one of the things. I'm not really a hawk or a dove. It just depends on the situation. And in this situation, there's really not a problem with using our military force against ISIS. That's a lot stickier situation when you're talking about what happened in Syria, especially considering that we had to actually call the Russians to get them to pull out first so that we could strike and not be striking troops of another country. So, completely different set of circumstances. Just thought I'd bring that up to your attention. All right. The call numbers are 860-1440 if you want to weigh in. Talk to me about this. Do you think this was a smart move by Donald Trump? You think it was excessive? Because I know that there's a lot of different opinions on this. Let me know what you think. 860-1440. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
I am a Christian in the only sense in which he wished anyone to be. Sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others, Thomas Jefferson.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call, weigh in. I did want to mention this. This actually just happened a few minutes ago. There's a piece in, let's see, what is this? Washington Post that I was reading just a second ago. Headline, the phrase mother of all bombs decried as sexist and grotesque. And what the whole thing is going through. They go through Twitter of various people, some of them well-known, some of them just random people. Here's one from Pam Day Butler. MOAB actually stands for Massive Ordnance Airburst. Trump is even sexist when referring to bombs. Nice consistency. As if Trump came up with the nickname. He's not the one that came up with that. That was way before then.
And he's not clever enough.
Well, maybe he's not. I don't know. Goodness knows whether you like Trump or hate him, he's not exactly known for his wit. He's known for his counterpunching, but that's not exactly the same thing. Who's this? Not a Tory. Why are we enforcing sexist gender roles on explosive ordnance? I thought that the liberals wanted women to be portrayed as strong and powerful. And when it came to the military, they wanted women in the military saying that women can do anything a man can do. And yet when we're using a female role as a nickname for a bomb, they lose their mind. Well, wouldn't portraying a bomb as female, which I know how ridiculous that is, but, you know, when confronted with ridiculousness, sometimes it's best to counter with equal ridiculousness, get to the absurdity. If that were the case, wouldn't portraying a bomb in a female role be something that would be considered empowering to women? That this is a massive, powerful explosion, it's a tool of war, and it's actually bigger than any other non-nuclear bomb we have in our arsenal. So if they were all about female empowerment and portraying women as powerful and independent, well, shouldn't they actually like the fact that the Moab bomb is being portrayed as the mother of all bombs? These things go on, and they just get continually more ridiculous. A guy named Eric Stroller says it's grotesque to call a killing device the mother of all bombs. The Moab is the epitome of lethal patriarchy. Oh, good grief.
What?
But, and well, since Joe asked what, maybe there are some people in the audience that don't know what that means either. The liberals commonly refer to patriarchy as just anything that, as a society, is run by men. And so they're saying that this is a symptom of a man-controlled world, which means that we're the lethal patriarchy is just the fact that we're engaged in warfare and disputes because men are running the world. Have you met women? If they were running the world, we would still have wars. If they were running the world, we would still have disputes. That's not a crack at women, but it's they say it as though women never get into disputes or arguments. That's not the case.
And there are some women who are world leaders.
Yes, there are. Quite a few, actually. There's a lady that, granted, I'm not a fan of her because she's a nationalist, but she's leading the polls right now to become the leader of France. So, you know, we've also got, Tarja Haladin, the president over there? We've got Angela Merkel in Germany. So there's quite a few female world leaders. Our ambassador to the UN is Nikki Haley. So... you know, it's just ridiculous. They keep going on and on and on. I could read these all day, but it just... this is one that I liked mocking it. This is Mike Speaks. I expect feminism will demand a career-focused childless single woman of all bombs next. So maybe that's the next step. I don't know. All right. Shifting gears here, though, for a second. I did want to talk about this. Now... goodness knows we've been following the whole Trump thing. This, to me, had to be mentioned. Ooh, excuse me. More powerful than I realize. I had to mention this. Trump has flip-flopped 6 times in one day. That was just a couple days ago. So I was looking through all of this. I couldn't believe how much Trump flip-flopped in one day because Trump's always been kind of a political chameleon, but this was a lot even for him. So I wanted to talk about the next one, the very first one before we get to the break, just because it is kind of interconnected to what we're talking about now. Trump has now said that NATO is no longer obsolete. Now, I do want to make an observation here. In this particular flip-flop, it is not as though he has changed his mind. He's saying that NATO used to be useless and worthless, and now since I've talked to the people in NATO, they're not. Now, this is actually a very positive flip-flop. It is a flip-flop. He has changed from what he was saying in the campaign. If you'll remember in the campaign, this is the guy that was saying during the campaign that NATO's worthless, we don't need them, we need to be getting out of NATO, it's not going to be there anymore, we don't need to be a part of it. Now he's saying the exact opposite. He says NATO does a lot of good work, they're fighting terrorism. Well, they were always fighting terrorism, even back in the campaign when he was saying they weren't. But this is a very positive foreign policy move, and I want to applaud the president on this. But I do want to observe... he has not changed his mind. He's just, his opinion of them has changed because he's saying that they have changed, which they really haven't. But one very positive movement, because Trump's chief complaint with them is a complaint that I thought was 100% legitimate, even though I disagreed with his conclusion, which is other countries involved in NATO should pay their fair share. He's right on that. I don't want the U.S. financing the defense for all the other countries involved in NATO. That is a fair criticism. And in part, I think because he said that, even though he didn't handle the negotiation himself, there are other countries that are now trying to get back and pay the amount that they had promised to pay. So I want to applaud Trump on this. Now, I'm not going to like all the flip-flops. We're going to go by each one case by case. But in this particular stance, I think this is a very positive move, positive direction for him. And I like the fact that his rhetoric has actually helped motivate some countries to pay their fair share. So I'm going to give him a pat on the back on that one. All right. More flip-flops when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. So that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me?
Welcome back. You are listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440, and don't forget the News Radio 1440 app. Call in 860-1440 if you want to talk to me about this. Now, we just talked about how Trump has flip-flopped 6 different times in the span of about 48 hours. Really, it was more like 24, but you know, it's been a little time since then, so I could collect all of them. Now, if you're counting this week, there's even more than that, but... we're going to dig into these. We already talked about NATO, which I thought was a very positive change. I applaud the president on changing his mind on that. Another one, this one's interesting because I don't really know how to take this one. I think it's good. I think I'm in favor of it, but I'm not sure. Because he has come out and said, China is not a currency manipulator. Well, here's the thing. They are. China has been manipulating its currency for a very long time. But so have we. Have you noticed how in the span of about a decade, the price of everything has gone up? It's not because of anything externally happening. It's because the Fed is printing money. It's because we're monetizing our debt. In fact, even though a lot of it isn't even really physical printing anymore, it's the Fed pumping digital dollars into the system. So you know how so much banking now is done online? Well, that online banking has to be backed up with real dollars. Well, under the Obama administration, a couple times, they pumped $4 trillion worth. Once, I believe it was actually digital money, the vast majority of it, into the system. And so, yes, China is a currency manipulator. And so are we. What I believe the president was trying to say, and the more specific, because this happens with Donald Trump all the time, and I'm not making fun of him, this is just how he is. We kind of hinted at this the other day, is that he'll make a very broad, sweeping statement that doesn't use 100% accurate terminology. Like when he was talking about wiretaps is a perfect example. I don't think anybody that's serious and honest thought that Trump meant literal wiretapping the way it would have happened in the 1940s. That somebody hooks up a line to your phone line so that they can listen in. That's not what Donald Trump meant, and I don't think that anybody that's serious on the left or the right thinks that that's literally what he meant. But, you know, he's not super precise with his language. And so when he says China is a currency manipulator, what I think that he was talking about is that China was manipulating their currency to artificially drop the price of their goods so that they could sell them to America and other countries. Well, here's the thing. That actually benefited us a lot when they did it, because it made their products cheaper for us. Now, his reasoning behind that, I suppose, if you're trying to find some logic behind all this, is probably that he didn't like the fact that them having cheaper products meant that some jobs that would have shown up in America wound up going to China. But the thing is, that's where they were gravitating anyway. And a lot of those low-skilled labor jobs were going to wind up in China anyway. But it was actually, for our economy, very beneficial because it meant that their prices were cheaper than they really should have been, and we got stuff for less money. I would be willing to guess that the vast majority of people within the sound of my voice, all or at least a large chunk of the clothing you're wearing is from China. If not, probably Thailand, maybe Mexico, but there are a couple other countries that it could have been. But that's just one example. They artificially dropped the prices. So, yeah, they were a currency manipulator, but it meant we got cheaper stuff. So if China wants to keep doing that, now it's a terrible policy for their country. It hurts their country. But as far as America, it doesn't hurt us. It actually helps us. It means we get cheaper products, which encourages more spending and gives us more disposable income. So if that's what he was talking about, and I don't know that, this is me trying to get in the president's head, which it seems that nobody's really talented at. If that's the case, then I actually didn't mind them doing currency manipulating. In fact, I wish that they would start it up again because it's been a while since they did it. It would mean cheaper stuff for us. But what this means, I think, is the far more important shift. Because if he has shifted on China, and what this means, what he means by this, is that policy-wise, he will no longer be trying to start up a trade war with China, putting massive tariffs on them like he was saying that he would in the campaign, then that is a very positive move. That's something I'm in favor of because I'm in favor of free trade. I'm in favor of not having tariffs on countries at all. I wish we would get rid of the ones that we've got now, to be perfectly honest, because that would also improve our economy. It would make products cheaper for us, cheaper for the American people. The only people that would be losing some revenue would be the federal government. And that's one thing that people don't understand when you're talking about free trade. But it looks like he will not be putting tariffs on Chinese goods, which meant that we will be paying less money for them, which is a net win for us. So if that's what he's talking about, and that seems to be the direction he's moving in, then I have to be in favor of this one, too. So far, we've got two flip-flops, both of them in positive directions, as far as I'm concerned. Now, Janet Yellen, this is an interesting one to me, because Janet Yellen is the person that's running the Federal Reserve. And during the campaign, President Trump said that she was an Obama shill, that she's just manipulating the markets and doing whatever Obama tells her to do. Now he's saying that she can stay, says that he respects her, that she can run the Federal Reserve, that she's competent, he has faith in her. This one I'm not as thrilled about because I've never been a fan of Janet Yellen. Now, she's not a political appointee. Her term will end, I think, in the next couple of years, and then she'll be appointed not by the president but by someone else. Honestly, I'd have to look up the process to see exactly how that works. But the point is, he's saying that she can stay. She doesn't, because he was saying she needs to go back in the campaign. So I'm not a big fan of Janet Yellen just because I'm not a big fan of the Fed and the way that they've been monetizing debt. So that one, I'm not real fond of him switching on. Now, this one, I'm really 100% against Trump on, which is he used to be saying that we need to get rid of the Export-Import Bank. Now he's saying that it helps companies and it does a lot of good. Granted, the Export-Import Bank, the average person walking around is like, what the heck is that? I've never even heard of it. Well, the reason you've probably never heard of it is because it deals specifically with international business. And they have a lot of different programs that they're involved in. But what they typically do, one of the things that bothers me the most, is that they essentially have risk management for losses overseas. Now, I know that sounds like economic gobbledygook, but it's actually pretty simple. What it's saying is if you have an overseas buyer, a buyer in another country for your product, and they don't come through, then the Export-Import Bank could actually pay you back the money that you would have gotten. So you essentially get free money for no product, even though when everything was going overseas, you actually had a buyer. Well, that's crony capitalism. That's bailouts that happen on small scale that are just as wrong. They're just as anti-free market as the bailouts for the big banks. But we don't see any headlines about them because there's not a legal process for them. I mean, the process itself is legal. But what I mean is Congress doesn't have to approve it. The president doesn't have to approve it. None of that happens. This all happens with businesses, both small and large, that do business overseas. And so what we've got is a way for investors to sell things overseas. And then if it just happens to not go through, instead of taking a loss like any normal business would do when you have a seller that doesn't follow through, then the Export-Import Bank can bankroll you for that. That's just one example. They do an awful lot of stuff. But the point is, no fan of the free market that I've ever run into actually likes the Export-Import Bank. I don't like the fact that the Fed is running any bank, whether it's this bank or the Federal Reserve. That was a big fight that our founders had, Hamilton being on the pro-bank side, Jefferson being on the anti-bank side, and Jefferson won out. It was the better plan. It was better for our country when we didn't have a national bank. And keep in mind, this is consistent with some of the things we know about Donald Trump. Keep in mind, during the campaign, he said that he would actually opt for a national bank. So it actually makes more sense, based on the things that we know about him, that he's in favor of the Export-Import Bank. I'm not sure exactly why he was against it in the first place. Maybe an advisor told him it was a bad thing or whatever it was. But this is one flip-flop that I'm absolutely 100% against. He's saying that now the Export-Import Bank helps a lot of companies. It does a lot of good. But if you are a fan of free trade, free markets, and businesses being held responsible, because you learn things from failure. You learn things from sales going belly up. You learn from your mistakes. You learn maybe not to pump in all that inventory at one time. Businesses learn from failure and evolve. Doesn't mean they have to go away. But if they do go away, they just make way for new businesses. That's how the free market system works. And when you inject a market distortion like the Export-Import Bank, then it messes with everybody's prices. And so what this can do is, it's not fair for you, the American citizen. Because if you own a small business and you try to sell a large amount of product to somebody and the deal falls through, Washington doesn't run to your rescue to bail you out, just like they did with the bank bailouts, just like they did with the motor company. It's crony capitalism and it's favoritism. And there are a lot of hardworking small business owners, some of the ones that are my sponsors, like Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center, that when they have something like that fall through, nobody runs to their rescue. They handle it on their own, which is the system that America was designed to operate on, the free market system. All right. So that being said, we'll get to more of these. We got a few more left when we come back. 860-1440 are the numbers.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Whoever is an avowed enemy of God, I scruple not to call him an enemy to his country. John Witherspoon, signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, tell me what you're thinking about. Give me some of your opinions on some of these flip-flops, good direction, bad direction. You know, what are you thinking about on this? Now, there was another flip-flop that I was pretty upset about. Apparently, Donald Trump has decided to lift the hiring freeze. Now, this was something that I did not believe that he was going to do in the campaign because he's, by his very nature, just not a small government guy. But when he came into office, I gave him kudos for freezing the hiring of federal employees until they got a handle on the budget, figuring out exactly what they were going to be doing that year. I thought that was actually a really positive thing. Trump has since lifted that ban on hiring people in the federal government. So that's something I'm not particularly thrilled about. I'm a small government constitutionalist. I want to shrink the size of government as much as humanly possible so that we have a small, lean federal government. But this move does not move us in that direction. See, the thing about Donald Trump is, and this was the case, and this was the case that I made to people during the campaign, his nature is big government. He's a, whether you think he's conservative or liberal or those other labels, what he is at heart, and this is what he's shown to be pretty consistent with, is that he is an authoritarian and he's a big government guy because authoritarians are big government. That's what makes them authoritarians. So whether you like him or not, maybe you like that about him. There are a lot of authoritarians out there that consider themselves conservatives. So when you're talking about authoritarianism, he just believes that the government ought to have a lot of say and regulate and control things. I don't. And that was one of the fundamental differences between me and him. This is one example of that being the case, is that Donald Trump believes that when, you know, when he wants to do, quote, what he has to get done, talking about him doing the job, that he believes that he is best suited to do that when the government is very large and that he's in control of it. And that's the problem that I've had with Republicans and Democrats, both federal level, state level, so on and so forth, is that they really don't want a small government because that limits their power. What they want is a very big government. They just want to be controlling it. And so what most of our elections are not arguing about what government should do, and they're not really arguing about good government. We're arguing about who gets to hold the keys to that big government. That's all it is. We're just switching who happens to have the key at the time. We're not changing the car itself. I want a little eco car that gets me from point A to point B with strictly no frills. That's my idea of what the federal government should be. Now, progressives, both Republican and Democrat, that like big government, which in many ways Donald Trump seems to be falling into this category more and more lately, they like a really, really big vehicle. I mean, an Escalade with all the bells and whistles, lights, PA system, lift. I mean, anything that you can imagine, they want it on, because there are no limits to what it should be in their opinion. And so they're arguing over who gets to drive the Escalade. I just want a little car that gets me from point A to point B, the bare bones necessity. That's all I want. But so often in our political climate, the argument becomes who gets to drive the car, when what we should really be arguing is what kind of car should we have and what should that car do? See, that's really the discussion we should be having. So the question is why? Why is all this happening? Why is Trump flip-flopping? Why has he changed his policy positions on this? As usual, with most things that Donald Trump does, I take this as a mixed bag. There are some flip-flops I really like. There are some flip-flops I really don't. I think he's made some positive movement. I think he's taken two steps back on some of them. But nonetheless, is he becoming more himself? Is this who he really is and he's just becoming the person that he always was? Or is he just listening to different advisors at this point? Because like he said, he's kind of a chameleon. He's kind of an empty vessel that can be filled up. That was the argument a lot of people made in the campaign. So maybe that's what's happening. On a couple, I think he's merely returning to his Democrat big government roots. Keep in mind, this guy was a Democrat for the vast majority of his life. He changed parties 7 times, I think, in his lifetime to independent parties, Democrat, Republican, back to Democrat. It just goes on and on. I mean, at the end of the day, the man is a political chameleon. Now, on some of these, I think that Trump has merely been won over by people that he likes and that like him, in reference to the Fed, for example. I think that he generally, when people like him and say nice things about them, he returns in kind. We saw this with Vladimir Putin. I never thought that Putin or that Trump was an especially, admirer of Putin's policies because he's not a political student. And so I always figured that because Putin said nice things about Trump, Trump figured he should say nice things about Putin because Trump's thinking, well, if they like me, they can't be all bad. So I think that really is what it is. And I'm not trying to belittle it. I'm just saying that that seems to be the kind of person Trump is. Now, here's the bigger point. And I want to drive this home because I think this may be the fallout of what all is going on here. Is Stephen K. Bannon out? Because here's the thing. Stephen K. Bannon, his strategist, his chief strategist, all these policy changes are things that he would abhor. Because Bannon hates NATO, he hates China, he hates the Fed, he hates the Export-Import Bank, one of the few things Bannon and I actually agree on. And he was probably the one that orchestrated the hiring freeze. So the question is, because in the past couple days, multiple sources have said that Bannon and Jared Kushner, who is another one of Trump's advisors and happens to also be his son-in-law, have constantly been at each other's throats. Remember the term that we talked about, and I have to be very careful with saying this because it can be easily mispronounced, cuckservative, C-U-C-K-servative. That's what Bannon called Kushner. He says he's a neocon, he's not a real conservative, he's just a globalist. And so they've had this infighting going on the past couple of days, and they've been at each other's throats. And then later, I think it was just yesterday, Trump said, this guy's just another guy. Bannon's just another person that I listen to. Well, that's not what he was saying about Bannon beforehand. Bannon was like the guy. He was the one that Trump always listened to, had the president's ear. So the question is Bannon on his way out? Because he's certainly been relegated to a lesser role in the Trump administration. At least that's the way it seems to be, because Trump is not going to side with him over his son-in-law, and they've had some pretty serious disputes. If that is the case, this is the best decision Trump has made since Neil Gorsuch. I will applaud him for getting rid of Bannon. Hour 2 coming up.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
What's up, preacher man?
The Governor Bentley scandal getting turned into a made-for-TV movie? What's that about? We'll find out now on The Patriot Preacher. Welcome back. Welcome back, everybody. Hour 2 of The Patriot Preacher is on now. Now, if you're wondering about my tease, I did something that I usually don't do in teases, which is I deceived you a little bit. Right now, there is no plan to make the Governor Bentley scandal into a made-for-TV movie. However, if you've been listening to my Saturday program for some time, you'll know that occasionally I do a bit called The Top 10. And what I've decided to do is I'm going to try to every week, just because it's a Friday show, it's a little bit lighter-hearted, I want to have a little fun with it. We're going to do a top 10 list. I'm going to try to do it every Friday. Not sure if I can get it done every single Friday. You know, it's the news. Things come up. But we're going to try to do that every Friday. And this Friday, we have the top 10 for the top 10 rejected titles for the Governor Bentley made-for-TV movie. So here we go. The top 10 rejected titles for the Governor Bentley made-for-TV movie.
All right.
Party on, Joe.
Party, party, party.
Yeah, there we go.
Party.
All right. The top 10. When Love Gov Met Flim Flam. Number 9. Captain Alabama, Civil Dispute. That one's for my lawyer friends. Number 8. How to Lose Your Job in 6 Days. Number 7. Skanks on a State Plane. Number 6. Bridge of iPhone Spies.
Oh.
Number 5. 50 Shades of Decay. Number 4. Dude, Where's My Wallet? Number 3. Doctor Strange Love Gov. Number 2. How the Grinch Stole Campaign Funds.
Mm-hmm.
And the number 1 rejected titles for the Governor Bentley made-for-TV movie. The Chronicles of Alabama, The Liar, The Witch, and The House Probe.
Oh.
And there we go. Yeah, the top 10 rejected titles for the Governor Bentley made-for-TV
movie. Wonder why they were rejected.
Probably because they were bad. But anyway, all right, just had a little fun with that. Of course, having a little fun at the former governor's expense. Give us some feedback on that. Let us know what you think. I'm always open to hear from the fans. If you have any ideas for a future top 10 or you have suggestions for that top 10, there are a lot of different variations on that. We can go in a lot of different places. It's something that I intend to have a lot of fun, and I would love to have some listener feedback on this. So if you have any ideas, you can always get in touch with me on Facebook or tweet me at Patriot Preach. If you like this, want to hear more of it, I'll probably try to have this up on the Patriot Preacher's channel. And of course, you can always check it out at our podcast. So be sure to look at that. I want this to be an interactive experience, not just for this, but also for other things as well. So if you want to call in, 860-1440, and don't forget our good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. They have been in business here in the capital city for 50 years. Been here a long time, and the reason that they've been here a long time is because people know them, people trust them, and they should, because they have a long track record. You don't survive that long in a city, in any city, without some advertising from word of mouth. People get to know you, people like your product, they like the service that you provide, and that's exactly what's happened with Jim Whittem Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. I absolutely love these guys. They take care of my truck. I never have to worry or give a second thought when they've done a repair because I know that they got the job done right and they did it right the first time. And what's great about it is even though they have a high quality of work, they don't overcharge you. They always have great prices and they're never out to bleed you dry. One of the things that I really loved about my experience there is when I bought my brand new tires and I'm riding on brand new Firestone tires that I got from Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center, is they gave me the tire that they knew I would be happy with. They didn't try to upsell me. They didn't try to give me a super expensive tire that I wasn't going to need because my truck has high mileage on it. They gave me the tire that they thought would both fit my budget and fit the needs that I had for my particular vehicle. And that's exactly the kind of service they'll give to you. So check them out on the Troy Highway in South Montgomery today. That is Jim Whittem Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. All right, got a lot to talk about today, but don't worry. We will be back. We're going to be talking about parents and your role as parents versus the schools. So interesting discussion, lots to talk about today. Give us a call, 860-1440. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Hey, welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers, as always, if you want to weigh in. Now, I would be really interested in hearing the reaction once I'm done with this story of some of our friends that I know that are listening in that are really involved in the education system here in Alabama. If she happens to be listening in, maybe Charlotte Meadows or Senator Dick Brubaker, I'd love to hear y'all's reaction to this. So this story comes out of a school system in Ohio where a kid named Candon Maple He's a 7-year-old. And this particular kid, he's a lot like 7-year-olds all around the country. He's kind of restless. He can get a little rambunctious. He's easily bored. Very smart. Usually finishes his work before his other classmates. And because of that, he has a habit of finishing his work and then being bored. And so he kind of acts out in class. And this is a problem that his parents have known about for a while, that his teachers have known about for a while. But he does have this problem. And so what wound up happening is this one particular day, he was acting out in class and he was sent to the principal's office, talked to the guidance counselor because he was disrupting class, and they were talking about it. And this kid, he has really strong family values, felt really bad about being scolded by the teacher and acting out. And, you know, the kid's just bored. He doesn't necessarily mean to cause any trouble. That's just who he is, or at least that's the way his parents have. So, I mean, this information is coming from his parents and their side of it, so keep that in mind. But so he was talking to the guidance counselor, and the guidance counselor asked, so what exactly, you know, you feel bad about this. What do you plan on doing about it? And he said, well, I just feel so bad that I wish I could erase myself from the world. And this startled the guidance counselor a little bit. She said, well, how exactly would you do that? And he said, well, I guess I would stab myself in the eye. So you can understand why the teacher was a little bit alarmed, called the boy's parents. The boy's parents went to pick him up, had a long talk with him, hashed it out, why he was disrupting class, why he was acting out like this, why he would say something like that. And he just said, well, honestly, I did it mostly to get a rise out of the guidance counselor. I didn't want to be there anymore. And so this kid is, you know, he's bored, he's acting out, he needs something to do. And unfortunately, that's what came out of it. I mean, he's 7. He didn't exactly think through all the repercussions of saying something like that would do. So that's what happened. They have been pushing for a while now for this kid to get ADD medication, or ADHD medication, sorry, because they have said that they think that he probably has ADHD. The parents have said, no, we don't think that that's the problem. We think that he's just getting bored too easily. And because of that, he acts out in class because he doesn't have enough to do. And, you know, they said that they would be fine with the teacher giving him extra work or something to keep him busy, but that's not exactly what's happened here. So they have said, well, you will medicate your son with your ADHD medication. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. That's not a diagnosis. That's not what's going on here. We know our son. He's just getting bored too quickly. That he does this at home when he has that problem too. And so he does something productive and it calms him down. So what happened with all of this and the outcome of this is that the center for, or the, what eventually happened with all this is the school had this back and forth with them. They refused. And so a few days later, after this incident occurred, Child Protective Services showed up with police officers and forcibly removed the kid from the house, citing parental neglect and abuse for not medicating their kid with ADHD medication. And he was gone for a month. They just got him back 2 days ago because a court ordered him to be returned to his parents. So the school reports this, and they forcibly removed the kid from his house. That was mind-boggling to me that they tried to actually remove and kept him away for a whole month. It's not like this was resolved the next day.
Mm.
So I'm, you know,
may actually you think maybe damage the little kid more than anything else?
Probably, I would think so.
It's got to be traumatic.
Well, I was listening to an interview with the parents the other day, and they did a radio interview with somebody. And they were talking about this particular incident. They said, well, he's happy to be home, but, you know, he was scared and he didn't know exactly what to do. It's not like they mistreated him or anything. But, I mean, they were Child Protective Services. But at the same time, you know, the kid was worried. He was separated from his mom and dad and his family for a whole month. And this family, the mom's a letter carrier. The father is a welder. And he, because his job doesn't require him to be at a specific place at a specific time, he stays home with the kids most of the day. They have, I think, 5 or 6 kids. So, I mean, these parents are not people that don't know what they're doing. They both have jobs. They both work really hard. They both raise several kids. I think this is either their youngest or second youngest, if I'm remembering the story correctly. So they've got a lot of kids, and they've been through stuff like this before. And they're saying, no, we know our son better than they do. We're not going to medicate him just because people tell us to. And they tried to cite this as abuse and neglect for not medicating the kid. So here's really the question and all of this that it comes down to, because this was the dad's stance. There is still a legal battle, even though the son has been returned to them, over whether or not Child Protective Services violated the law by A, unreasonable search and seizure, first and foremost. They didn't have a warrant. There was no crime that they were suspected of. The police officers just busted into their house and took their kid. So there's a pretty big legal dispute there, if nothing else. And secondly, I think that this really goes to it, and I want to understand exactly what you think about this, because I've been around kids in schools my entire life. I was a teacher's kid. I've actually taught high school classes. I've taught college classes before, not the whole class, just, you know, an individual lesson here or there, filled in for teachers, that kind of thing. So I have a little experience with this. But I think that this all goes back to a baseline question, which is, do your kids belong to you, or do they belong to society? Because if they belong to society, there's nothing wrong with this. If this is just the village's kid, well, then if they see that the kid isn't getting the care that the village deems appropriate, the village can take him and provide that care. But if your kid is yours, then you decide what's appropriate. I mean, within certain constraints, of course, but you decide whether or not it's appropriate to medicate your kid, because if the government can control what goes in and out of our kids, then they control everything, because kids are not of the age of majority. They're not citizens yet. And so what this all goes back to, I actually had a similar discussion with myself and Elkins, and he brought me in because he wanted to hear my perspective on this, brought me in on the air live. I didn't know that he was going to do that when this happened, about a grandfather that refused to medicate his granddaughter for religious reasons, and she wound up dying. At least in that particular stance, even though if the man had a real religious reason for not medicating his granddaughter, it's tragic, it's unfortunate. At the same time, I can understand where that argument lies. I can understand where the argument lies in that maybe in an extreme case like this, if the child's life is in danger, that there might be an opportunity for the government to intervene. At least in that particular situation, I can understand the argument. I don't understand the argument here. ADHD medication is not going to save anyone's life. The child was not in danger because of the situation that he was in, not getting Ritalin or whatever else it was that they were wanting him to take. So I don't, there's no legal leg to stand on in this, in my particular opinion. If they wanted to kick him out of the school for not taking these drugs, I understand that argument. I do. And that's not what I would want. And if there were a school board that did that, I would argue against it. But my point is, at least from a legal perspective, I understand the argument there, because schools do get to choose, even public schools, because that's what the local populace has decided is what's best. They can decide, for example, if your kid has not been vaccinated for certain diseases, you're not allowed to attend their school. I understand that. It protects the other kids. And so if this kid is disturbing class to the point that other kids can't learn, and they say, well, you're either going to medicate him or we're going to kick him out. I don't like that. I wouldn't have supported that decision myself. But at the same time, there's a legal precedent there. You can say to that kid, that makes sense because they have to worry about the other kids and their learning. But to take the kid away from his parents, that brings it to a whole other level. To actually forcibly remove the kid, not just take him out of school, but take the kid out of his house and away from his parents because they refuse to give him ADHD medication, that to me is the height of absurdity. That's very different than, that's abducting a child. And it's a blatant violation of the Constitution on top of that. All right. 860-1440 are the numbers. I do want to hear some of your opinions on this. We do have a caller on line one. Let's go to Jim and see what he has to say. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Hey, what's your take on this, Jim?
Well, I think this is ridiculous. I'm going to be 66 in about another few weeks.
Oh, well, happy birthday.
Yeah, well, I made it. I went to school, elementary school in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Back when you, you know, I lived across the street from the school I went to. Back when there were neighborhood schools.
Right.
Back where, you know, the parents had a relationship with everybody in the school, and everybody knew everybody. All my times in school, and I know things change. I know medicine has made progress, stuff. But when I was in school, nobody even heard of ADHD. There weren't all these weird things. You know. I just kind of remember all the time I was going there. You know, we just had discipline, and it took care of the problems. I think this ADHD thing, I don't know, I think it's gotten way out of control.
No, I actually agree with you.
It's an excuse to medicate somebody, and I think it has long-term effects on a person's brain that gets riddled at this age. I think it does. It really has an effect on them.
You know, they say that the time that you're a kid, your brain develops in certain ways. It develops patterns in a way that's completely different from the rest of your life. Yeah. So those are your formative years. Your brain is forming patterns. It's forming grooves, in a sense, that it can go through a particular, you know, a pathway to form thoughts, that kind of thing. And so, don't get me wrong, I'm not a clinical psychologist or anything like that, as you can probably tell by the way I'm talking. But what that does is, if you do affect it artificially with an outside source like a drug, I'm not saying that there aren't cases where that's necessary, and there is some risk evaluation there. But at the same time, there is an argument to be made for holding off on that until you are an adult, so the person, has already have a fully formed mind, and secondly, they're able to make their own decisions on things like that. And so you're absolutely right. I do think that ADHD and ADD and other learning disabilities, I think that they're absolutely real. I think that they're a real problem, that each family should make their own decisions on how they're going to deal with it. But at the same time, I do think they're grossly overdiagnosed.
Yeah, I mean, but basically, you're giving the person speed is what you're doing.
Right.
And it's, you know, I just, like I said, I know progress is made in medicine, but I just don't remember seeing all these problems like that because the parents took care of it, the situation. My mom and dad raised five boys and a girl, and you know, we knew what the problems were, and my dad took care of it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or my mom. And I just think this, I just not real, this Ritalin thing is, I just think when you take somebody that's 6 or 7 years old and start giving them something like this, you're just setting them up for something that's going to be bad later on. I just don't, I think there's other ways to solve this problem. But as far as the government coming there and taking these kids, I mean, that's just ridiculous.
I know, it's insane.
I mean, it's got way out of control.
It's insane what they're doing, Jim, and thank you for your call. Thank you for voicing your opinion there. No, I agree, and what bothers me about this the most is that they didn't even give the parents time to handle it because they showed up just a couple days later and they called the Child Protective Services that day before the kid even got home. So the school and the government, they're not even giving the parents time to hash it out. You know, if he's a repeat offender and they have to kick him out of school, that's one thing. But they didn't even give the parents a chance. It's their kid. It's not the government's kid. More on this when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The great pillars of all government and of social life. Virtue, morality, and religion. This is the armor, my friend, and this alone that renders us invincible. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. Call in 860-1440 if you want to say what's on your mind, weigh in, tell me what you're thinking about this. So to give you a quick recap of what we've been talking about, right before the break, we brought up the story of Camden Maple, a seven-year-old, who he's a student in an Ohio school system, and he got a little rambunctious, got in trouble, and the school said, well, we're going to need the parents to start giving him medicine for his ADHD. And the parents said, no, we're not going to medicate our son. Well, after that happened, a couple days later, the authorities show up and forcibly take their son out of their house, and they held on to him for about a month, and they only gave him back because a court ordered them to. So
that's the thing that every time you mention it, that just, and we talked about it after the break about basically kidnapping the kid and the trauma. How could a 7-year-old just will not understand and will have trouble adjusting to that?
Right. I mean, I don't see how that's not child abduction. And frankly, if I were the parents, and I don't think that they've done this yet, they're just trying to wade through the legal battle on their hands now. If that were the case, that's the charge that I would bring is child abduction. So, at any rate, this was my initial reaction to this story after hearing it. You have to keep in mind I'm an ag guy. Been an ag guy my whole life. My father's an ag teacher at a public high school and been around animals my whole life. I've been showing lambs since I was 3 years old. So I've been working with animals literally, I mean, all my life. I've always been around them. It's always been part of my environment. When I first heard this, it sounded to me like what we do to our animals if we're having trouble with them. Because they're animals, they're not people, and we're the ones in charge of taking care of them. Sometimes when an animal gets unruly, you drug them just to calm them down. We had one particular show heifer, for example, that was the biggest pain in the butt I've ever dealt with. And my sister, who is a very tiny girl, had to show this, you know, several hundred pound heifer, and this heifer was already a problem. And so when she was working with her to try to get her ready for the show before we actually went into the ring, we gave them a little calf calm, which is a drug that you can inject into your animal, and it kind of calms them down because she couldn't handle her when she first started working with her. And so when we were trying to break this calf of being, you know, a problem, we just gave her a little calf calm so she would be easier to work with and so it would be easier to train her. But here's the thing. That's cattle. It's not kids. And furthermore, it's not someone else's kid. And so what this story sounded like to me is that the government is starting to treat kids like cattle. The teachers are having problems handling this kid. He's causing problems for them, causing problems for the other kids. So, again, I understand the argument if that's the one that they make. I wouldn't necessarily support it, but I understand the argument of this kid's causing disruptions for the class and so we can't keep him in school. I get that argument. I think that the teacher should be a little more proactive in trying to figure out how to deal with a kid like that. But my overall point is that at least I understand the logic behind that. That's different than taking the kid from his parents and then drugging him. Because that's what they did. They took him away from his parents so that they could give him the ADHD medication. That's what we do with our livestock, not with people's children. And I think it has a problem with progressivism has essentially treats people like they're livestock, like we're cattle. We're all just members of the herd. They have to, from their high ivory towers up in Washington, dictate mandates because we're just livestock. We're not smart enough to figure things out on our own. They have to control the masses. And this is just one small sampling of that. This is one small example of how they think of us, as though we're just some big mass that needs guidance because we're not smart enough to run our own lives. Now, in this particular case, it bothers me that this kid needs extra work. He needs more of a challenge. And we live in a world that is so customizable. That's the reason that the millennial generation is the way that it is, because we've essentially lived our entire lives with everything customizable. Everything can be made exactly to our preferences in a lot of ways. You look at social media, you look at the way online shopping has come about, you look at the way we shop for things like groceries and so on and so forth. So much in our life is customizable, and technology has allowed that to be the case. And yet education is one size fits all. And it's been that way for a really long time now. That wasn't always the way it was. But it bothers me that this kid, the solution, it seems to me, is to give this kid something to do, not to try to medicate him to make him easier to deal with. And I will say this in the teacher's defense. This is probably not the teacher's fault. I would imagine that this teacher is probably just doing, I assume it's a woman because most elementary teachers are women, could be a man, I suppose, probably just trying to do her job. And she has one kid that's unruly and disturbing the rest of the class, and she sees that she has to take some kind of action to fix that. I don't blame her for that. That's probably not unreasonable, and she probably was worried about not reporting something like this. And when he got to the guidance counselor and said what he did, which, first of all, that was a leading question that she kind of asked him, what would his plan be if he were to kill himself? She didn't actually ask him if he was planning on doing it. But furthermore, they were probably worried about the liability. And so really what this goes back to is this is some educrat that made up this policy, in my opinion, that probably made this call. Because what the educrats do is they negate liability and they come up with hoops for people to jump through. That's really about all they're good for. They try to keep the school from being sued, and they will take absolutely any stance, regardless of how insanely ridiculous it is. And I'll tell you some stories about that some other time that I've had my own experience with them. And then they come up with hoops for people to jump through because they, especially in this state, they'll say that people need to be held accountable. We have to know exactly what's going on. And so they come up with lots of forms or exercises or meetings that they have, which really don't do anything to help the kids themselves or the teachers. They're just more hoops to jump through. And so I wanted to share a story really quickly with something my dad, who was a teacher, he used to do this all the time. And this teacher is probably young, doesn't want to get in any trouble. My dad could kind of get away with things because he was very old school and had been there a really long time. My father never had a bored kid. And the reason he never had a bored kid in his class is because if they were bored, he made them not bored anymore because he found them something to do. I can remember as a kid, I was afraid to ever say to my dad, I'm bored, because if I said I was bored, he's like, oh, we can find some work to do. And that's exactly the way he handled kids in his class. If he had a kid finish their work early, tell them he was bored, he had them sweep, or he had them, you know, do some kind of paperwork or, you know, help them out with something like that, file something, organize something. That's what he did. And that because of that, the kids never told them that he was bored and they didn't act out in class because he would find something for someone to do. And even with kids with special needs and special disabilities that they needed help with, my dad had quite a few of these. And there was this one kid that was special needs, and he figured out that the best way to keep this kid calm, keep him from disturbing the lesson or disturbing class, is he put him in charge of the dog. My dad had a dog that he brought to class sometimes, and all he had to do was give the dog to the kid, let him take care of him. He says, this dog is your responsibility. You're supposed to take care of him for the rest of the class. Kid was fine. He just needed something to focus on. That's it. And he was still learning. He was still paying attention to the lecture. But he had something to take his mind off of the things that he wanted to be thinking about. And that solved all the problems. Teachers, I think, are no longer encouraged. And I'm not blaming the teachers themselves. I'm blaming the system. I don't think teachers are encouraged today nearly as much to come up with creative and innovative solutions the way that they used to. And I think that that's a shame because we have a lot of really good, talented teachers that could probably come up with something, but couldn't get away with it in the system that we have today. And that's really a shame, because what my dad always did was treat everybody like he expected something good out of them, that he expected them to behave right and he expected them to grow and produce. And see, the greatest sense of accomplishment that I think a person can have is when they mature through understanding that they did something that they didn't think they could do. Whether it's as simple as something behaving in class or giving a presentation to something far more complicated. We grow when people expect things out of us and push us to accomplish them. Because sometimes we don't believe that we can do things. I've fallen into that as well from time to time. And I had talented teachers and other mentors along the way that did believe in me, that did believe that I could do something. And here I am. That was really one of the things that really helped me grow. And I think that there are teachers in the system that would want to do this, but unfortunately that's no longer encouraged. All right. We do have one caller we're going to get to before the Star Spangled Sermon. Let's go to Mike on line one. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. I work in the system here in this city.
And, yes, sir.
I'll tell you, it is the law that if you, as a teacher, suspect some sort of, well, I don't know how to say this. Well, you have to report it. So
right.
DHR comes in, or if they have to come in, you're covered. Legally, you're covered. If it turns out there's nothing to it, you're covered as well legally, so nothing can happen to you.
Right, and I don't have a problem with that law. They probably should have reported that.
Right, and you know, so that's good in the fact that you have to keep your eyes and your ears open and all that, you know. I think what you were talking about, though, is a bit beyond the pale. And I agree with you on that. Yesterday I was filling in for a teacher, and I sent the student to the office, and he never made it to the office. So his mother came in, and after school we had a conference, and she just told the principal, "You have my permission to put the board to him."
Well, you know, I think they're... I'm sorry, Mike. I got to go to a break.
I know. I'm going to let you go because I know you have something else. But the thing about it is, his little girlfriend was an in-school suspension. And, he wanted to be with her in-school suspension.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he was doing all he could to be in there with her.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll let you go.
Thank you so much, Mike. Appreciate what you do. Appreciate your teaching kids. Yeah, no, I think that's part of the problem. I'm in favor of people reporting things. If you see something, say something in education. I get that. But you also have to give the parents a chance to deal with it themselves, and you don't take the kid away from the parent. If you have to remove the kid from the school, that's one thing, but you don't take the kid from his parents. All right, so that's my thoughts on it. Star Spangled Sermon will be next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Colossians 3:17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. Wanted to issue the Star Spangled Sermon. I was going through the book of Leviticus, and this story has always stuck out to me that there are several truths in it that I think we can glean from the narrative given here. It's important to understand a little bit about this. There are two men who are priests, and this is right after the formation of the nation of Israel. They're actually not even in the Promised Land yet. This is written when they're still roaming around, wandering in the wilderness with the tabernacle, trying to get into the Promised Land. There are two men, Nadab and Abihu, who are the sons of Aaron. Aaron, of course, being the older brother of Moses. And the Levitical tribe, which the book of Leviticus, that's what it's named after, these are the essentially instructions for the priest of Israel. And to be a priest of Israel, you had to be of the Levitical tribe. And in this particular case, these are Aaron's sons, and Aaron is the high priest. He's the first high priest. And so his sons are offering worship in the tabernacle. So that's where this starts. Leviticus 10, 1 through 3. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they did die before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, "It is what the Lord spoke, saying, 'By those who come near me, I will be treated as holy, and before all the people, I will be honored.' So Aaron, therefore, kept silent." So these are two men that kind of came to his throne to worship with a sense of flippancy. They didn't take it seriously. They didn't do the things that God asked them to do. And because of it, they died. The Lord consumed them with fire, as the scripture says. So what does this tell us? God takes worship seriously, and he expects us to take it seriously too. I think that it's an unfortunate side effect that our current culture thinks of God almost like a buddy, almost like an equal in a lot of ways. There are a lot of people that have tried to, in my opinion, over-humanize God. Now, God did become a human. he was Jesus Christ, but he was still God. And there is a difference between God and man. Now, there is supposed to be an intimacy, a level of friendship, and sort of a family tie, which is the reason the analogy that's usually given is that God is our Father. That's correct. That's biblically accurate. And like a father, I do think that there is supposed to be a mutual back and forth of love and respect. But at the same time, there is supposed to be a level of reverence. You wouldn't speak to your father the same way you would speak to one of your buddies. I don't speak to my dad or my mom the way that I speak to my frat brothers or with my buddies at church. We just have a different relationship. And I think in a lot of ways we've dumbed that down a little bit because we've dumbed down the relationship between our physical parents and the children and put them more on an equal playing field in our society today. And I think that's a side effect of that. But the takeaway from this story should be when God says something, he means what he says, and he is going to be treated as holy one way or another. And in this case, the ones who did not treat him that way paid for it with their lives. And this is not the only two people that did so. But when God commands something, it's not a suggestion. He's not saying, hey, it might be a good idea if you did this. It's not a request. When he commands you to do something, it's supposed to be followed, and it's supposed to be followed in the way that he prescribes it. So this is one of the things that I've always noticed about this story. It says, they offered fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. Now, he commanded them to offer fire at the sacrifice. And they were supposed to offer fire from the place that he said to offer it from. They offered it from a different place. That's why it says strange fire. It was fire that was not of the temple. So, with everything that's going on here, notice God didn't tell them to not offer strange fire. He didn't say, don't offer fire from somewhere else. He just said, you're going to offer fire from here. God means what he says. And he expects us, when he gives a command, to have enough common sense to know he wants it followed his way, not our way. We're supposed to do it the way he wants us to, not the way we want it to be done. That's the point of worship. All right, that's our show. PatriotPreacher.com. Stay the course, friends.
The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.